is Nightline.
Tonight, taking the stand. Kyle Rittenhouse, in his own words.
Why do you need the gun when you go out there?
I need the gun because if I had to protect myself because somebody attacked me.
The 18-year-old accused of murder during last year's Kenosha protest. The high-stakes courtroom drama.
Don't get brazen with me.
Will it all lead to a mistrial? Plus, saving paradise. Australia's Great Barrier Reef.
This sprawling natural habitat is teeming with marine life.
Follow the team working to preserve one of the great wonders of the world before it's too late.
We've been able to re-establish breeding coral populations within just 2 to 3 years.
And
we're all insane.
We take you to the big night, the CMA Awards.
We're all insane.
Good evening. Thank you for joining us. It was a gamble. Kyle Rittenhouse taking the stand today in his own defense, the 18-year-old on trial for murder, after a deadly encounter during a night of protest last year following the police shooting of Jacob Blake.
Defense will call Kyle Rittenhouse.
It was a day of explosive turns in the murder trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. This morning, the 18-year-old who shot and killed Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber, and injuring Gage Grosskreutz during a protest over racial injustice, taking the stand in his own defense.
So I didn't do anything wrong. I defended myself.
The defense painting him as a concerned citizen, protecting private property and giving medical aid, who acted in self-defense.
So you felt that as a 17-year-old, it was appropriate for you to be out on the streets of Kenosha with an AR-15 that night. Fair?
The prosecution, as a vigilante and an outsider who took two lives that night in cold blood. What's happening here inside this Wisconsin courthouse, reigniting conversations around the nation's racial divide and seen by some as a commentary on the justice system at large.
What I'm suggesting is if he's acquitted, we're now seeing the law is also saying it's okay to pick up a gun and take the law into your own hands.
Black Lives Matter!
In the summer of 2020, protests spilled into the streets after 29-year-old Jacob Blake was shot in the back 7 times by a police officer in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
All my grandson asked repeatedly is, why did the police shoot my daddy in the back?
And up, go, go,
the shooting sparking outrage, protests demanding justice, but turning deadly when armed men who authorities called vigilantes clashed with protesters. Among them, then 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse from Antioch, Illinois, who was seen guarding a car repair shop that night, telling Blaze TV he was armed with lethal ammunition.
We're protecting from the citizens, and I just got pepper sprayed by a person in the crowd.
And after shooting and killing two and injuring another, would turn himself into police. He's now pleaded not guilty to 6 charges, including first-degree reckless homicide and first-degree intentional homicide, and could face life in prison. On the stand, Rittenhouse testifying Rosenbaum threatened him before the shooting.
Sorry for my language. He screamed, if I catch any of you f***ers alone, I'm going to f***ing kill you.
And that he was scared for his life, breaking down in tears as he described the moments leading up to shooting Rosenbaum.
Mr. Rosenbaum was now running from my right side, and I was cornered from in front of me with Mr. Zeminski, and there were there were 3 people right there.
We're going to take a break about 10 minutes. And
the judge pausing the proceedings.
The problem with a breakdown like that is if you're inclined to believe him, you feel sorry for him. And if you're inclined not to believe him, you think he's faking it. And so there's always a danger when something big like that happens in the courtroom. This is a case where, at this point, the defense wants to take as few risks as possible. Kyle Rittenhouse breaking down on the witness stand could be a risk. It just depends on how the jurors view it. But in the end, I don't think him breaking down on the witness stand is going to make or break this case.
Certainly none of us know a man's heart, but you and I both have covered enough trials to know. What was your reaction to Rittenhouse's emotion on the stand?
authentic?
No, to be quite honest with you, no. In fact, I was really surprised at the number of people who were comfortable saying that he got emotional. He appeared to be going through something, but I'm not sure if it's authentic or not. But whether it was authentic or not is secondary to this. We don't know what he was crying about.
Since August 25th, 2020, this is the first time that you have told your story.
In cross-examination, a Rocky star for the prosecution, and fireworks after the judge asked the jury to leave the courtroom, admonishing the assistant district attorney.
You are already, I was astonished when you began your examination by commenting on the defendant's post-arrest silence. That's basic law. It's been basic law in this country for 40 years, 50 years.
When someone chooses not to speak, that's a constitutional right that can't be used against them. Fundamental issue. And the judge was basically saying, you are now trying to use that against him. And that's totally improper.
The prosecution also seemed to allude to evidence that the judge had previously banned.
Don't get brazen with me. You knew very well, that an attorney can't go into these types of areas when the judge has already ruled.
Skirmishes with the judge are dramatic and they're interesting, and lawyers get riled up about them. But in the end, it's not going to determine the outcome.
While the defense team called for a mistrial based on out-of-bounds questions, the prosecutor continued, taking Rittenhouse step-by-step through the events of that day, pressing him on his decision to go to Kenosha in the first place, whether he was expecting to be in danger when he showed up with an AR-15.
Why do you need the gun when you go out there?
I need the gun because if I had to protect myself because somebody attacked me.
Why would you think anybody would do that?
I don't know.
And playing this video in court. Attempting to dismantle Rittenhouse's argument that he was in Kenosha that night to offer medical help.
You're not a certified EMT. You're not an EMT of any kind. You weren't on that night, correct?
Yes.
So you lied to him, correct?
I told him I was an EMT, but I wasn't.
And attacking his claim, he shot Rosenbaum in self-defense.
Joseph Rosenbaum never touched you in any way during that incident, correct?
He touched my gun.
He didn't touch your body in any way, did he?
No. If he would have taken my gun, he would have used it against me.
To use deadly force, you have to have reasonable fear of great bodily injury or imminent death. But in the end, these jurors are going to decide this case by basically saying, has the prosecution proven beyond a reasonable doubt that it wasn't self-defense?
For many, the outcome may speak to larger issues at play.
You wrote a powerful article about the meaning of this trial beyond what happens to this young man. You made the point about, for you, not just as Mr. Rittenhouse on trial, but vigilante justice is on trial.
Absolutely. It's quite interesting to watch these two trials, both the Ahmaud Arbery trial that's taking place in Georgia, as well as this trial here with Kyle Rittenhouse, because at the end of the day, they both are about vigilantism. And it's about vigilantism through the prism of race. If he's found innocent, if he's acquitted, then you essentially are saying everything that precipitated before he started firing into the crowd, into those individuals, wasn't as bad. And I think that sends a very dangerous message.
A verdict could come as early as next week. Up next, one of the world's greatest natural wonders, the Great Barrier Reef, inside the efforts to save it.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Climate change has taken its toll on the natural world, and Australia's Great Barrier Reef is no exception. But scientists are trying to intervene, hoping to preserve this amazing natural wonder for generations to come. Our Brett Clinett traveled there as part of ABC's Climate Crisis series, Saving Tomorrow.
It might look like paradise from above, but beneath the turquoise waves of the Coral Sea, picturesque views turn to the barren expanse of a struggling ecosystem. This is the reality of one of our world's greatest treasures, the Great Barrier Reef.
This sprawling natural habitat is teeming with marine life, but it's the maze of coral, the heartbeat of the Great Barrier Reef, that sustains the life here. And that's why it's so important to win this fight to save the reef.
And that heartbeat continues to be under attack from climate change. Back-to-back coral bleaching events in 2016 and 2017, and most recently in 2020, have left their mark on parts of the reef where coral was too hot for too long and withered away.
That's the research boat over there. We're about to link up.
Hello, how are you? Thanks for having us on board today.
We meet marine ecologist Dr. Peter Harrison and his squad of graduate students near Black Island Reef off the Australian coast, an area severely impacted by coral bleaching in recent years.
We've lost so many adult breeding corals that the production of larvae is now compromised. So that's how and why we're intervening.
The Great Barrier Reef stretches over 133,000 square miles, is visible from space, and helps fuel area fisheries and tourism. Its importance is not in dispute, but for some in Australia, climate change is, despite the eroding state of the nation's prized ecosystem. Peter's team is hard at work trying to preserve a small coral community through their larva cultivation operation.
Tell me about this project. What are we getting done today?
So today is the culmination of a year of planning and using new styles of delivery of the coral larvae onto damaged sections of the reef. We collect some of the immense coral spawn that occurs at the sea surface, and then we carefully transfer the eggs and sperm and the embryos that are developing into these floating larval culture pools that are anchored on the reef. Those larvae are now ready to settle.
The team of scientists have tens of millions of microscopic coral growing in these pools. They're trying to emulate the natural brown clouds of coral spawn, typical on the reef during this time of year. The spring-like weather conditions are ideal for breeding. That will change once the summer heat rolls through in the coming weeks.
What we're going to do is pull the pools over to the back end of the boat here, raise them up and concentrate the larvae, get an estimate of how many million larvae there are.
When we take the samples, right, so that we can then calculate how many larvae are in the whole pool.
So what part of the process are these larvae?
So these larvae are now 6 days old, those ones, and those larvae are at a point now where they will want to settle, so that's why we're going to put them back on the reef now.
A successful outcome from today will be a result of many more larvae settling on the reef and growing into new corals than is occurring naturally.
Peter says his team's replanting efforts elsewhere on the reef have ushered in reclaimed ecosystems, demonstrating the resiliency of coral-dependent biospheres under stable ocean temperatures.
We've been able to re-establish breeding coral populations within just 2 to 3 years. And those coral communities are now dominating what were really highly degraded reef systems. So we're very excited by those results.
But Peter's small operation is only part of the solution to revitalise the countless reefs that are struggling in Australia's coast.
In 2016, we saw a 30% drop in coral cover across the whole Great Barrier Reef. They didn't slowly die of starvation.
2 weeks, that's all it took.
They cooked. And the temperatures that year were about 3 degrees centigrade and above the normal summer maximum.
Dr. Terry Hughes directs the Centre for Coral Reef Studies at James Cook University in Australia. He's been sounding the alarm on the devastating effects climate change is having on the Great Barrier Reef for years.
We used to worry about the impacts of cyclones because they're quite destructive on corals. Now we wish for a cyclone during very hot summers because bleaching has become so commonplace that we now have weather forecasts that predict bleaching in the coming weeks.
Hughes says public visibility of the reef's overall health is key, particularly from those whose livelihoods depend on it.
The Great Barrier Reef today, after 5 bleaching events, is a checkerboard of reefs that are in good condition and not so good condition. The tour operators know the good spots, and they're quite selective in where they take people.
Right.
To ensure that they have a good experience.
In 2019, Cairns-based Passions of Paradise began planting coral on damaged parts of Hastings Reef, in addition to running their tour operations for vacationers.
So there are some reefs we go to that are 11 out of 10, would absolutely blow your mind. Without a sustainable approach to our operation, we don't have anything to show people.
Every bit helps, but it's still not enough, as global greenhouse emissions continue to climb. In the coming years, the new challenge for researchers will be finding ecologically and socially responsible ways to breed heat-tolerant coral that's also cost-effective.
We're not looking at seeding a few hundred or a few thousands onto the reef. It's likely that hundreds of thousands or even millions of corals will be required. But there's a lot of knowledge that we have to gain before we get to that point.
Back out on the water, Peter and his team are using the knowledge scientists already have on the inner workings of these organisms. In just one day, they successfully released more than 3 million coral larvae, hoping each spawn finds a place to settle and thrive on the recovering reef. But it's a drop in the bucket, and Peter knows much more needs to be done to ensure the entire Great Barrier Reef can thrive once again in the decades to come.
We need real and effective action internationally and in Australia on climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. Otherwise, the future of the reefs looks very bleak.
And finally tonight, it was a who's who of the brightest stars of country music. Yeah! Yeah! Chris Stapleton, who took home 6 CMA awards, including Male Vocalist of the Year, teamed with Jennifer Hudson to bring down the house in a tribute to Aretha Franklin. You play me happy. And that's Nightline for this evening. Catch our full episodes on Hulu. We'll see you right back here at same time tomorrow. Thanks for the company, America. Good night.